Shalom, everybody, and we welcome you to this week's 5-minute update, where we examine the news from the past week as it relates and pertains to major Bible prophecy of the end of days. And in this week's 5-minute update, we're going to focus on the current situation with the peace process, as well as I would like to share with you a significant article regarding the prospects of the U.S. economy. First, let me try to summarize what the current status of the peace process is before I read you the detailed articles. There was the second round of meetings that took place September the 14th in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, and then the next day, September the 15th, in Jerusalem. George Mitchell said that all the core issues were being discussed, and Netanyahu and Abbas were seriously discussing them. Mitchell also said that work is well underway for a framework agreement. And then there is a major issue that still hasn't been formally decided, and that is the status of the September 26th building freeze that is coming up. Will the Israeli government extend that building freeze in the West Bank, which the Palestinians want to apply to East Jerusalem as well, or is Netanyahu going to give the go-ahead to continue and stop the construction freeze? Now, his coalition partners are saying that if he extends the construction freeze, that what will happen is they will work to bring his government down. However, the Palestinians have stated that if there is a stop of the construction freeze, that they will not go forward in the direct peace talks. So as a result, the United States wants Israel to extend the settlement freeze for 3 months. Aaron Klein on WorldNet Daily is reporting that the Israeli government has made gestures to the Palestinians that will include the extending of the settlement freeze, releasing Palestinian prisoners, and giving the Palestinians greater control of certain areas in the West Bank. However, the inner cabinet of Israel this past week has decided to not extend the settlement freeze. So based upon that, there is conflicting information which is coming out. And then following the talks with Israel and the Palestinians, George Mitchell flew on to Syria and Lebanon to update them on the talks. And there are two aspects to why he did that and what is going on. One is that the talks between Israel and the Palestinians are progressing, and George Mitchell is working to have a comprehensive agreement in the region that would include Syria and Lebanon, as well as the PLO. The other school of thought is the United States tries to bring up the Syrian track whenever the Palestinian track is failing. But in going to visit Syria, George Mitchell is taking with him a Israeli withdrawal map from the Golan, wherein the Israeli government is seeing if Syria is willing to have a peace agreement, disassociate itself with Iran and Hezbollah in exchange for giving back the Golan. However, Israel wants to implement this over an extended period of time, perhaps even up to 10 years. Meanwhile, the international community, the European Union in particular, and Great Britain as well, sees the Israeli settlements as illegal under international law. So that's an overview of the information from the articles that I am now going to share with you, beginning with the one from the Jerusalem Post, September the 16th. The headline is, Mitchell says that Netanyahu and Abbas are tackling the toughest issues first. Israel and Palestinian Authority have moved further in a few days of intensive negotiations than the two sides in Northern Ireland conflict did in many, many months. And George Mitchell negotiated the resolving of the conflict in Northern Ireland. In the current talks, Mitchell said, within a matter of literally days since this process began, the leaders have engaged directly, vigorously, with what are among the most difficult and sensitive issues that they will confront. The U.S. believes this is a strong indicator of their sincerity and seriousness of purpose. They are serious. They mean business, Mitchell said. They have differences, but we believe they can be overcome. Mitchell's comments to the press followed hours of discussion at the Prime Minister's residence in Jerusalem between Benjamin Netanyahu, Mahmoud Abbas, and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and their respective staffs. Mitchell's remarks seemed to indicate that the sides were not only talking about how to overcome the settlement construction moratorium, but also about core issues such as security, Jerusalem borders, and refugees. He refused, however, to shed any light on the nature of the compromise being worked out on the moratorium issue, other than to say that the issue was being tackled and that progress was being made. The talks Mitchell sounded so upbeat about started when Abbas arrived at the Prime Minister's residence in the afternoon. In the guest book, Abbas, who had not been in that structure for more than 2 years, wrote, "Today, I return to this home after a long absence with the hope of achieving lasting peace in the whole region and especially peace between Israel and the Palestinian peoples." The presence of the Palestinian flag put an end to speculation about whether Netanyahu would fly the Palestinian banner in his residence, a practice Prime Minister Ehud Olmert initiated when he negotiated with the boss. A senior official in Netanyahu's office said that Netanyahu hosted Abbas with friendship and generosity, including the placement of the flag. But the source said as if the placement of the flag could have an impact on the content of the negotiations, that in the talks themselves, Netanyahu remained firm on Israel's security needs. For Netanyahu, there is no compromise on this matter, the source went on to say. The next article is from Israel Today, September the 15th. The headline is, Talks Take a Familiar Turn Against Israel. Israel and Palestinian leaders held their second round of direct talks in the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh on Tuesday. U.S. envoy George Mitchell described it as a serious discussion on core issues and announced that the drafting of a framework agreement on a final status solution was well underway. According to Israel's Channel 1 News, Netanyahu is scheduled to fly to the United States this Sunday for a previously unplanned meeting with administration officials. The news anchor said that the trip is 90% certain, but had no further details on what will be discussed. Of course, it is fairly easy to surmise that the meeting has been called so that U.S. President Barack Obama can get up close and personal with Netanyahu about putting an end to Jewish settlement and growth in the Jews' historic and biblical heartland. Further than that, there is little information available regarding the current talks. Israel and American officials have said that most of the negotiations are deliberately taking place behind the scenes to prevent the media and public opinion from influencing the leaders involved. Israelis have heard that kind of thing before, and in the past that meant that the talks were taking place largely in secret to prevent an Israeli outcry or even a toppling of the Israeli government over excessive concessions or the breaching of Israeli red lines. So, from George Mitchell stating that the atmosphere of the talks were good, they were tackling the tough issues, that drafting of a framework agreement is well underway, and that Netanyahu was perhaps planning to go to the United States on Sunday, those would be indications that progress is being made toward a framework agreement. And of course, according to the Palestinians, in order for them to be satisfied, Israel must extend the settlement freeze. And the United States has suggested that the extension be 3 months, so that during the next 3 months, an agreement can be made on the borders of a Palestinian state. From Ynet News, September the 16th, it says, U.S. wants borders set in 3 months. London-based Arabic language newspaper says, United States hopes to overcome obstacles of a settlement freeze, suggests Israel prolong a freeze by 3 months during which borders will be resolved. The United States is trying to circumvent the obstacle posed by the settlement freeze in the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks and has devised a compromise which will allow the sides to make progress on other issues. The London-based Arabic language newspaper reported Thursday that U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has suggested a compromise according to which Israel will prolong the settlement freeze by 3 months and the time period will be used by both parties to reach an agreement on the border issues. The Prime Minister's office responded to the report by saying that there was no change in Benjamin Netanyahu's stand on the matter. We will not comment on the content of the negotiations, the Prime Minister's office said in a statement. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's stance on the period set in advance for the suspension of new construction in Judea Samaria is well known and has not changed. According to the report, once new borders are set, Israel will be able to resume its settlement activity in the areas remaining under its control and will cease all activities in areas it is expected to withdraw from. The newspaper said Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has accepted the offer, while Prime Minister Netanyahu has yet to give his offer. And then WorldNet Daily reports, September the 14th, that Israel will extend a freeze on Jewish construction. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will partially extend a freeze on Jewish construction in the West Bank and will implement a de facto freeze on some eastern Jerusalem communities, according to sources in the Israeli government. Palestinian Authority officials, meanwhile, told WorldNet Daily they received a U.S. pledge that Israel will free a number of Palestinian prisoners as well as transfer to the Palestinian securities control of several West Bank areas in the coming months as part of a series of Israeli gestures to the Palestinians. While Netanyahu has not made any public statements regarding a freeze extension, the Israeli government sources told WorldNet Daily that Netanyahu will not allow any new Jewish construction in the foreseeable future in the West Bank or eastern sections of Jerusalem, excluding what are known as the three main settlement blocks, which are Gush Etzion, Ma'ale Adumim, and Ariel. Palestinian Authority officials, meanwhile, said the U.S. has been negotiating the borders of a future Palestinian state that would see Israel eventually withdraw from most of the West Bank and some areas of eastern Jerusalem, with the exception of the three main blocks. While the Palestinian Authority does not believe it will see an actual Palestinian state within a year, it expects in that time it will take over many more neighborhoods in the West Bank and eastern Jerusalem that are normally controlled on the ground by Israel. The Palestinian Authority said the expectation is based upon pledges, but they said the United States received a pledge from Netanyahu to transfer more security control of the West Bank towns, as well as a release of a number of Palestinian prisoners, as gestures to entice Abbas to stay in the peace talks. So all of these things would suggest an extension of the settlement freeze and serious talk on a framework agreement and agreeing to borders of a Palestinian state. And in a Haaretz editorial, which I'm going to share with you, this article mentions that an initial framework agreement and then a full-fledged peace agreement is the pattern after the Israel followed as a part of the Oslo process, which was an idea of Henry Kissinger. And so I'm going to read this editorial from Haaretz by Ari Shavit, and the headline is Plan B for Peace. This article is September the 16th. So the editorial goes on to say, on October the 5th, 1995, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin presented the Oslo II Accord to the Knesset. In the speech he made on that momentous occasion, Rabin pledged that in the final status agreement, Jerusalem would remain united, the settlement blocks would remain part of Israel, and the security border would be the Jordan Valley. He also said Israel would not return to the June 4, 1967 lines, and that the Palestinians would run their own lives in the framework of an entity that would be less than an official state. There are only three possible explanations for Rabin saying these things, which, a month later, became his last political will and testament, as in November of 1995 he was assassinated. One is that he was a fool. He did not understand that there can be no Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement without dividing Jerusalem. The second thought is that he was lying. He knowingly said things that were not true about the parameters of a future peace. Rabin was neither a fool nor a liar. He was a student of Henry Kissinger. Rabin and Kissinger believed that the occupation could not last and that the settlements were a disaster, but that peace was distant. Therefore, they thought that instead of seeking an impossible final status agreement, they should work toward a long-term interim agreement, an agreement that would not end the conflict but would quiet it down. Such an agreement would not solve the problems of Jerusalem and the refugees, but it would establish an independent Palestinian entity. It would allow Israel and the Palestinians to live side by side without ruling over each other and without killing each other. Netanyahu is now to the left of where Rabin was when he was murdered. Netanyahu is prepared to go further than the point of which Rabin spoke about in October of 1995 when he stood before the Israeli Knesset. Like Rabin, Netanyahu demands Jerusalem, the settlement blocks, and the Jordan Valley. But unlike Rabin, Netanyahu has come to terms with the establishment of a demilitarized Palestinian state. The positions of the leader of the right in 2010, that is Benjamin Netanyahu, are more moderate than the positions of the leader of the left, Yitzhak Rabin, in 1995. So, Netanyahu is indicating flexibility that would make him to the left of Yitzhak Rabin in 1995. But the article says there's a problem. In exchange for what Netanyahu is willing to give, he is demanding an end to the conflict. In exchange for the end of the conflict, the Palestinians are demanding what Netanyahu is not willing to give. The only solution, according to this editorial, is to think out of the box, not to fail exactly where the president's Bill Clinton and George Bush did, but to return to the pragmatic path of Henry Kissinger and Yitzhak Rabin. To sit Israelis and Palestinians down in a closed room and task them with formulating a long-term interim agreement, which I would interpret as a framework agreement. Instead of U.S. President Barack Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Special Middle East Envoy George Mitchell making fools of themselves in a vain effort to reach a barren, full-fledged agreement, they should immediately start preparing an alternative plan. And that alternative plan, according to this editorial, is divide the land of Israel now through a framework agreement and work to establish full-fledged peace later. So, is Israel and the Palestinians in the United States working to do exactly what this editorial says should be done? Are those the signs that Mitchell is giving when he says that progress is well underway for a framework agreement? Is that the purpose and the goal of the United States wanting to extend the settlement freeze for 3 months? Is that the reason why Aaron Klein on WorldNet Daily is reporting that Israel is strongly considering agreeing to those proposals? If so, those are all indications that we are going to see a framework agreement in the near future. However, on the other hand, we have a report from the Jerusalem Post on September the 17th that Netanyahu's inner cabinet has rejected an extension of a settlement freeze. Thus, Netanyahu couldn't have a settlement freeze. Thus, Netanyahu would not agree to a settlement freeze. So, this article states, September the 17th, the headline, "Government rejects an extended freeze despite heavy pressure." Despite considerable pressure from both the United States and Egypt to continue the settlement construction moratorium for another 3 months, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's senior ministers, a forum known as the Septet, decided this week not to extend the freeze. Since a cabinet decision was needed to put the freeze into effect last November, another cabinet decision would be needed to extend it. And the Septet decided before Netanyahu's meeting in Jerusalem with U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on Wednesday not to ask for an extension. Defense Minister Ehud Barak reportedly was in favor of an American compromise to extend the moratorium for 3 months in order to come to an agreement with the Palestinians on finer borders, so that it would then be clear where Israel stood and where it would not be able to build. So this report says Defense Minister Ehud Barak is in favor of the 3 month extension, but the inner cabinet is not and does not want to see that come about. So we are getting conflicting reports about where things are going and what the decision is going to be. And since the deadline is September the 26th, we should know this coming week what the decision is going to be if they make it before the September 26th deadline. But my understanding is that the next round of talks is going to be on September the 26th. And so maybe that is the day from those talks where the decision is going to be made. We can only wait and see. But the decision that will be announced is going to be major regardless of what it is. There's going to be consequences and ramifications on the left and the right side of Israeli politics. The settlers, meanwhile, are stating that if there is an extension of the settlement freeze, they will regard it as a declaration of war against them. And from the national.ae, this is September the 15th, The headline is, West Bank settlers are upset over Obama's pressure. A Jewish settler in the West Bank is fed up with the United States telling her country what to do. The policy of Israel is whatever America says, claims Mrs. Arbuckle, who moved to this hilltop settlement 19 years ago. But America isn't on the right side. The right side for her, she quickly added, is Israel's side. The Council of Jewish Communities in Judea, Samaria, and the Gaza Strip, which represents the settlers, plans to launch a media campaign to persuade the Israeli and U.S. publics that the strategy to extend the settlement freeze is flawed. If Netanyahu continues the freeze, said Mr. Masika, who heads the Shomron Regional Council, we will see it as a declaration of war. And so those are seeds of rebellion in the West Bank by the settlers to the potential establishment of a Palestinian state. So once again, conflicting reports, one indicating that there very likely could be a framework agreement in the near future, an extension of the settlement freeze. But on the other hand, the inner cabinet of Israel has voted to not extend the settlement freeze, and publicly Netanyahu is stating that he is not going to extend the settlement freeze. So based upon these talks, George Mitchell then visited Syria and Lebanon to update them regarding the talks. So there are two views regarding this event. One is progress was being made regarding a framework agreement, and the United States would like to see Syria included in any agreement with the Palestinians as part of a comprehensive regional peace. The other view is that the Palestinian talks are breaking down, and the United States wants to see if any progress can be made regarding the Syrian track and Israel withdrawing from the Golan Heights. So from the Ma'an News Agency, the headline is, George Mitchell says Obama seeks Mideast normalization. Mitchell spoke with reporters following a trilateral meeting between Mahmoud Abbas, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Mitchell himself. The official announced a series of meetings between Clinton and Abbas, and later King Abdullah II of Jordan, as well as an agreement for Abbas and Netanyahu to meet the following week. That would be this coming week, to lay the groundwork for the next round of talks at the leadership level. The location of the next round of talks was not announced. Mitchell said he would also continue bilateral talks with regional officials, starting with Syrian President Assad in Damascus, along with his foreign minister. Mitchell said he would then travel to Lebanon on Friday for discussions with Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri and his parliamentary speaker. I will brief the Syrian Lebanese leaders and seek to elicit their support for our shared goal of a comprehensive regional peace, and will do the same in the next few days with many other leaders from this region, Mitchell explained. The official also stressed that U.S. President Barack Obama's goal for Mideast peace efforts included full normalization of relations between Israel and all of its neighbors in the region. Now, that is only possible through the acceptance of the Arab Peace Initiative. And he did not discount questions around a possible push toward a peace deal with Israel and Syria. Discussions with Lebanon and Syria, Mitchell added, are complementary and mutually beneficial if we can proceed toward a comprehensive peace on more than one track. And on this issue from Haaretz, the article is September the 16th. The headline is, Mitchell tells Syria Israel-Palestinian talks could yield comprehensive Mideast peace. So the Haaretz article says, the United States assured Syria on Thursday that its focus on securing a peace deal between the Palestinians and Israel would not deflect the United States from pushing for an Israeli-Syrian agreement. Our efforts to resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in no way contradicts or conflicts with our goal of a comprehensive peace, including peace between Israel and Syria, George Mitchell said after meeting with Assad in Damascus. Indeed, we believe very strongly that a foundation of good faith negotiations between the Palestinians and Israelis can and should support the entire structure of comprehensive peace, he added. Absent that foundation, which is being set in place just now as we speak, anything that we could try to build with others in the region would not stand. Our effort to resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in no way contradicts or conflicts with our goal of comprehensive peace, including peace between Israel and Syria, Mitchell said in his statement. As President Barack Obama said, comprehensive peace in this region includes a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, between Israel and Syria, and between Israel and Lebanon, and the full normalization of relations between Israel and its neighbors. Channel 10 in Israel reported on Tuesday that Hoff visited Israel this week and told Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that Assad wanted to resume talks with Israel without preconditions, but was seeking American assurances that Israel would withdraw from the Golan Heights. With that in mind, Debka file reports September the 16th that George Mitchell, when he went to Syria, he took with him Netanyahu's proposed map to withdraw from the Golan. Following the two-day Israeli-Palestinian face-to-face talk supervised by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and George Mitchell, prepared for a major U.S. diplomatic breakthrough during his visit to Damascus Thursday, the possible revival of a Syria-Israeli peace talks. He carries with him for Syrian President Saad a detailed map drawn up by Benjamin Netanyahu to represent Israel's proposed withdrawal from much of the Golan. The Israeli Prime Minister refused to go into borders between Israel and a future Palestinian state at the talks he held with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas in Egypt on September the 14th. First, he wanted to dispose of other issues such as security. His tactics for Syria are quite different. 3 months ago, Netanyahu showed Barack Obama detailed maps of the Golan, showing how far he was willing to pull Israeli forces back, provided that Assad followed in the footsteps of the late Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, who visited Jerusalem in November 1977 and was rewarded with a full peace accord with Israel and the recovery of the entire Sinai Peninsula and its demilitarization. Two conditions for Assyria. A second Israeli condition for negotiating a peace plus withdrawal pact is the severance of Syria's strategic and military ties with Iran and termination of its backing for Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Palestinian terrorist organizations enjoying Syrian sanctuary and hospitality. When he visited the White House on July the 6th, Netanyahu presented this plan to Obama as his ultimate objective. However, Debka file sources in Washington report that the U.S. President Hillary Clinton and George Mitchell have adopted it and giving them enough leeway to tempt Assad into peace diplomacy with an active American hands-on approach. Our sources report that France has been brought aboard the initiative. When French President Nicolas Sarkozy saw the Netanyahu map, he appointed the eminent diplomat Jean-Claude Cazeron as special envoy for promoting Israeli-Syrian peace accord. Cazeron was in Syria on Monday, September the 13th, and spoke privately with Assad. Right after that conversation, D'Alessi told the White House and Hillary Clinton that the door was open for Mitchell to present Netanyahu's proposals and map. This week, the Obama administration has embarked on two major Middle East diplomatic projects in a hope that by striking gold in at least once, its mediators can stimulate a second. Bledka Files Jerusalem sources note that while the U.S. and French presidents have made privy to Netanyahu's peace initiative en masse, shown exclusively here on Debka File, the Prime Minister has never shown them to his own government, his security cabinet, or his inner Prime Minister has never seen them, that group of seven, except Defense Minister Ehud Barak has seen the Golan withdrawal map. So Debka Files report indicates that perhaps a framework agreement is being made with the Palestinians, and they want a deal on a framework agreement to include an agreement with Syria as well. So that is one school of thought. The other school of thought is coming from Israel Today, and the headline, September the 16th, is the U.S. set to give up on Israeli-Palestinian talks? This article says local international media outlets on Thursday were full of stories of purportedly positive meeting between Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas in Jerusalem a day earlier. But those stories also contained a tidbit of information that suggested the Obama administration sees the renewed negotiations going nowhere and is already set to move on to its next peace effort, restarting Israeli-Syrian talks. Despite the seemingly impassable roadblock that talks have hit, or rather was hit, when the Jewish building freeze officially expires on September 26, Mitchell tried to paint a positive picture. Within a matter of literally days since this process began, Mitchell said, the leaders have engaged directly, vigorously with what amount to be the most difficult and sensitive issues regarding the conflict. The U.S. believes this is a strong indicator of their sincerity and seriousness of purpose. Mitchell tried to compare the situation to his negotiations to resolve the situation in Northern Ireland, where he brokered a Good Friday peace agreement in 1998. He noted that in those negotiations, it took nearly 2 years before the sides had a serious meeting about important issues. However, Mitchell then indicated that Washington believes this round of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations will end like its predecessors when he announced that the U.S. had started working on restarting Israeli-Syrian peace talks. Mitchell was expected to fly to Damascus as part of that effort on Thursday. Israel cannot conduct serious peace negotiations with both the Palestinians and another Arab entity at the same time, as conflicting demands would make it impossible for Israel to move forward. The U.S. government knows this, and in the past, whenever the United States started pushing the Israeli-Syrian track, it was because there was an understanding that talks with the Palestinians were going nowhere. Meanwhile, the view of the international community, that would include the United States, as well as the European Union and Britain, is that the Israeli settlements and their construction are illegal under international law. This was reiterated in the Web Inquirer website, and the headline is that William Hague calls Israeli settlements in Palestinian territory illegal. It is only weeks after the Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, caused an Israeli flare-up by calling Gaza a prison camp. Now, Foreign Secretary William Hague is stirring up the embers by saying that all settlement activity in the occupied Palestinian territory is illegal and is an obstacle to peace. He has called on the Israeli government to freeze all settlement construction, including the natural growth of existing settlements, and dismantle all outposts built since 2001, as well as extend the freeze to East Jerusalem. It is expected that once new borders are set, the Israeli settlement will resume, but limited to the areas that end up remaining in its control. We therefore look to the government of Israel to take all necessary steps to renew the settlement moratorium. We have made that quite clear to them, Hague says. So that's the information we have to allow us to understand the current situation on the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. And so I've shared with you that we're getting conflicting reports. On one hand, indications that progress is being made on the framework agreement. Israel's going to extend the settlement freeze for 3 months, release Palestinian prisoners, give the Palestinians greater control over certain areas in the West Bank. And with that expected progress, approaching Syria to see if they're willing to accept an Israeli withdrawal from the Golan as part of the peace agreement, and working toward a comprehensive peace in the area if Syria is willing to disengage from Iran. And perhaps these talks with Syria is the last effort to see what exactly Syria is willing to do before the United States and Israel possibly attacks Iran, perhaps in 3 to 6 months. They want to make every effort to see if they can get an agreement with Syria before that decision is ultimately made. So on one hand, that may be what's happening, but on the other hand, if the inner cabinet of Israel has said we will not extend the settlement freeze, then perhaps that will be the decision of the Israeli government, and the Palestinians will decide to no longer continue with direct talks. So with the outcome of the next round of talks, which should be in the next week or 10 days, we should know ultimately what the decision is. Now, I'm going to move on to the U.S. economy. And the media in the United States and financial news programs give us conflicting reports as well. On one hand, they want us to believe that the economy is doing better, but on the other hand, there's all types of signs that the stimulus is not working, and now with interest rates in the United States at about 1%, that being the Fed funds rate, that the Federal Reserve can't lower interest rates anymore, so they can't help and stimulate the economy through that means. And so with the U.S. economy still not fully entering into recovery mode, the Federal Reserve is indicating that they're now going to take the next step and to buy U.S. Treasury debt. Now, buying U.S. Treasuries is the same as printing money. It's called monetizing the debt. And that is the step that happens and precedes the devaluing of a currency and hyperinflation. So watching to see what the Federal Reserve in the magnitude they take action in this area is hugely significant. So before sharing with you this bit of news, and then what I regard as a very significant article from leap2020.eu in their September newsletter, which is about the situation with the U.S. economy, I want us to first remind you that Lindsey Williams, in talking with his globalist insider from his report at the beginning of 2010, said that there was a desire that in 12 months, that would be the end of December of 2010, that the plan was to devalue the United States dollar anywhere from 30 to 50%. And in another article, which I shared in a previous five-minute update, there was inside information that indicated that if that would happen, the United States would need to have the banking system down for a week to 10 days. And that the most opportune time to do that was following Christmas, between Christmas and New Year's, when there's a lot of holidays anyhow. And so if there is a plan to do that in the late December, early January time frame, we would need to see indications that the Federal Reserve is taking the approach of monetizing the debt, printing money to pay U.S. debt, and this would cause a lack of confidence in the financial markets, and that would cause a run on the dollar, and the dollar losing its value, which would need to have a, or it would result in a devaluation of the currency. So that is why these articles now I'm going to share with you is so important, because it is a sign of the last step before the currency collapses, which results in hyperinflation. So from Reuters, September the 13th, the article is, the Federal Reserve is to buy $27 billion of U.S. Treasuries and TIPS. The Federal Reserve will buy about $27 billion of Treasuries and Treasury inflation-protected securities in nine operations from September the 15th through October the 6th, the New York Fed said on its website on Monday. The Federal Reserve said at its August 10th meeting that it would buy treasuries using funds from maturing agency bonds and mortgage-backed securities in an effort to keep steady its holding of domestic securities. The Fed has already purchased about $17.5 billion of securities in nine operations between August the 17th and September the 13th. So the purchase of the $17 billion and the $27 billion is probably too small for there to be a lack of confidence being shown in the financial markets regarding the U.S. dollar. Even though this past week the euro rose from about 126 to 130 or 131 against the dollar, which was a significant rise. But the fact that they are beginning to buy treasuries is an indication of future direction. But the important article is the one that comes from the Wall Street Journal, September the 14th, wherein a Goldman Sachs top economic person, Jan Hatzias, says to expect more quantitative easing or monetizing of the debt by the Federal Reserve, and gold prices as a result should be going higher. The article says Goldman Sachs top econowork Jan Hatzias here at Market Bear Central, we refer to him colloquially as Johnny the Hat, says the Fed may announce a new round of quantitative easing as early as November. That would be in addition to what they've announced already, what I just shared with you. Quantitative easing, at least as recently practiced by the Fed, is essentially printing money to buy U.S. debt. Over at Real Time Economics, Luca Di Leo was keeping an ear on the webcast dubbed A Return of Fed Easing. Hatzias hosted today, and the following is reported by Jan Hatzioff, a chief economist at Goldman Sachs. We do not expect this announcement at the September 21st Fed meeting, but in November or December, there certainly is a possibility that it will be announced. He added that the Fed is likely to buy U.S. Treasuries worth around $1 trillion to kickstart the economy. Now, buying that amount of Treasury notes would be the huge and significant buying of U.S. debt, monetizing the debt. If they would make that announcement in November, we could see the collapse of the financial system, a lack of confidence shown in the U.S. dollar, and the need to devalue the dollar at the end of December or early January. So this news information lines up with what Lindsey Williams reported the thought process was regarding a 30 to 50% devaluation of the dollar at the end of 2010, as he reported in the beginning of 2010. And this time reference as well lines up with the current issue of LEAP 2020. This is their September newsletter. And this newsletter is all about the United States debt situation. And so the headline of this newsletter is "The Global Systematic Crisis of Spring 2011. Welcome to the United States of Austerity and toward a very serious breakdown of the world economic and financial system." So if the Fed announces a buyback of $1 trillion of U.S. debt, it will result in what LEAP 2020 is stating. So I want to read their entire public announcement of their analysis of the current U.S. economic situation, because I agree with their analysis in this article. And many people like Peter Schiff and Gerald Celente are saying the exact same things as in this LEAP 2020 report. So let me share it with you. It's 3 to 4 pages, but it's very important to understand the details of this analysis. It is as follows. As anticipated by LEAP 2020 last February, in Report 42, there and then, in February, it was stated that the second half of 2010 is to be characterized by a sudden worsening of the worldwide financial crisis marked by the end of the illusion of recovery maintained by Western leaders and the thousands of billions swallowed up by the banks and the economic stimulation plans of no lasting effect. The coming months will reveal a simple yet especially painful reality. The Western economy, and in particular that of the United States, never really came out of recession. And that's what Gerald Celente says. The startling statistics recorded since the summer of 2009 have only been the short-lived consequences of massive injection of liquidity into a system which had essentially become insolvent, just like the U.S. consumer. At the heart of the global systematic crisis since its inception, the United States is, in the coming months, going to demonstrate that it is, once again, in the process of leading the economy and global finances into the heart of darkness, because it can't get out of this very great U.S. depression. Thus, coming out of the political upheavals of the U.S. elections in November, with growth once again negative, the world will have to face the very serious breakdown of the global economic and financial system founded over 60 years ago, that would be at Bretton Woods, 1944, on the absolute necessity of the U.S. economy never being in a lasting recession. Now, the first half of 2011 will dictate that the U.S. economy take an unprecedented dose of austerity, plunging the planet into new financial, monetary, economic, and social chaos. In this newsletter, our team therefore anticipates for the coming months different aspects of this new development of the crisis, especially the nature of imposed austerity, which will affect the United States, the development of the accursed inflation-deflation argument, the actual progress of real U.S. GDP, the strategy of central banks, and the direct consequences for Asia and Europe. That all of those things are discussed in the full report, which is only obtained by subscription. In this issue, we have chosen to present an extract of the anticipation concerning the forthcoming austerity, which will be imposed on the United States beginning in the spring of 2011. Now, it can only be imposed if we have a devaluation of the dollar. The coming quarters will be particularly dangerous for the world economic and financial system. The chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, passed on the message as diplomatically as possible at the recent meeting of world central bankers at Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Even though the policy to revive the U.S. economy has failed, either the rest of the world continues to fund U.S. deficits at a loss and hopes then at some point the bet will pay off, avoiding a collapse of the global system, or the United States will monetize its debt, that is buying back U.S. treasuries, and turn all the dollars in U.S. treasury bonds held by the rest of the planet into funny money. Like any power at bay, the United States is now forced to introduce the threat of pressure to get what it wants. Barely a year ago, the rest of the world's leaders and financial officials had volunteered to refloat the U.S. ship. However, today things have drastically changed since the noble assurance from Washington. The Fed's, like that of the Obama administration, proved to be only pure arrogance based on the pretense of having understood the nature of the crisis and on the illusion of possessing the means of controlling it. However, U.S. growth evaporates quarter after quarter and turns negative again from the end of 2010. Unemployment hasn't stopped growing, and between the stability shown in official figures and the exit, in 6 months or more than 2 million Americans in 6 months of more than 2 million Americans from the workplace. LEAP 2020 believes that the real unemployment figure is now at least 20%. The U.S. housing market remains depressed at historically low levels and will resume its fall from the fourth quarter of 2010. Last but not least, as one can easily imagine in these circumstances, the U.S. consumer is and will be absent on a permanent basis since his insolvency continues and even gets worse for the one American in five without work. Behind these statistical factors hide these realities that will radically change the U.S. and global political, economic, and social landscape in future quarters as and when they draw on public consciousness. First of all, there is very depressed, widespread reality, a real trip to the heart of darkness, which is that tens of millions of Americans, nearly 60 million, now depend on food stamps, who no longer have a job, no longer have a house, no longer have any savings, are wondering how they will survive in the years to come. The young retirees, African Americans, workers, service employees, etc., they constitute this mass of angry citizens who will speak violently next November, that's this coming November, and plunge the United States into a tragic political impasse. Supporters of the Tea Party and new secessionist movements want to break the Washington machine, and by extension that of Wall Street, without having feasible proposals to solve the country's myriad problems. The November 2010 election will be the first opportunity for this suffering America to express itself on the crisis and its consequences. And won back by the Republicans or even Tea Party people, these voters will help to further cripple the Obama administration in Congress, and the election will probably swing toward the Republicans, only pushing the country into a tragic gridlock just when all the signals turn red again for the U.S. economy. This expression of widespread anger will, in addition, from December onward, collide with the release of the deficit commission report set up by President Obama, which will automatically place the issue of deficits at the heart of public debate at the beginning of 2011. For example, we are already seeing a very specific expression of this widespread anger against Wall Street in that Americans have deserted the stock market. Each month, an increasingly number of small investors leave Wall Street and financial markets, today leaving more than 70% of transactions in the hands of major institutions and other high-frequency traders. If one keeps in mind the traditional image that the stock exchange is today's temple of modern capitalism, then we are witnessing a phenomenon of loss of faith comparable to people's disaffection with official demonstrations experienced by the communist system before its fall. The Federal Reserve now knows that it is powerless. Finally, there is a financial and monetary effect that is particularly tragic since the players are aware of their inevitable situation. The U.S. Federal Reserve now knows that it is powerless. Despite the extraordinary efforts, that is, zero interest rates, the beginning of quantitative easing, or printing of money, huge support for the real estate mortgage market, massive support for banks, and tripling of the Fed's balance sheet that is carried out from September 2008, the U.S. economy will not restart. Fed leaders are finding they are only a part of the system, even if it is a vital part, and therefore can do nothing against a problem that affects the very nature of the system. In this case, the U.S. financial system, designed as the solvent heart of the global financial system since 1945. But the U.S. consumer has become insolvent. The consumer who, during the last 30 years, has gradually become the central economic player of this financial heart, with more than 70% of U.S. growth dependent on household spending. It is this insolvency of U.S. households that has broken the Fed's efforts. Accustomed to the virtualization and thus to the possibility of manipulating the process and dynamics of events, U.S. central bankers believed that they could mislead households once again, giving them the illusion of wealth and thus pushing them to revive consumption and behind it the whole United States economic and financial machine. Until summer of 2010, they did not believe in the systematic nature of the crisis, or they did not understand that what was causing the problems was out of reach in the tools of the central bank, as powerful as it may be. Only in recent weeks have they discovered two pieces of evidence. Number one, their policies have failed, and they don't have the arms nor the ammunition to solve the problem. Hence, the very depressed tone of the discussion at the central bank's meeting in Jackson Hole, where the lack of consensus on future action, whence the endless debates about the future, the risks to be faced in the coming months. Is it inflation or deflation? Knowing that the system's internal tools used to measure the economic consequences of these trends are no longer even relevant as we analyze in this issue. Whence increasing violent clashes between proponents of renewed growth versus debt and followers of deficit reduction. And whence Ben Bernanke's speech, full of veiled threats to his central banker colleagues, in ambiguous terms, he passed along the following message. We will try everything and anything to avoid an economic and financial collapse, and we will continue to finance this. Everything and everything. Otherwise, we let inflation loose and thus devalue the dollar, while U.S. Treasury bonds will no longer be worth much. When a central banker expresses himself like a common cash extortionist, there is danger in the house. The response of the world's central banks will be unveiled in the next two quarters. Already, the European Central Bank has made it clear that it thought that a new policy of stimulation through an increase in U.S. deficits would be suicidal for the United States. Already, China, while saying it would do nothing to rush things, spends its time selling U.S. assets to buy Japanese ones, reflecting the historic level of the yen-dollar exchange rate, where the U.S. dollar is at a 15-year low against the Japanese yen. As regards Japan, it is now forced to align itself simultaneously with the United States and China, which will probably cancel out all of its financial and monetary policies. In future quarters, the Fed, like the federal government, will find that when the United States is no longer synonymous with juicy profits and shared power, its ability to convince its partners declines quickly and heavily, especially when the latter questions the relevance of the United States policies. The consequences of these three realities that are gradually making their presence felt in U.S. and global consciousness will therefore, for the Leap 2020 team, come to pass in the spring of 2011 by the United States entering an era of austerity unprecedented since the country became the heart of the global economic and financial system. Federal political blockages in the context of an electorate sick and tired of Washington and Wall Street, heavy reliance on federal funding of the entire U.S. economy, and the Fed's impotence against a backdrop of growing international reluctance to finance U.S. deficits will combine to push the country into austerity, an austerity that has, moreover, already begun to affect at least 20% of the population head-on, and which directly affects at least one in two Americans worried about joining the ranks of the homeless, those without work, and other long-term unemployed. For these tens of millions of Americans, austerity is here, and it's called lasting impoverishment. What is going to come into play between now and the spring of 2011 is, therefore, the shift into official speeches, budgetary policies, and international awareness to the idea that the United States is no longer the land of plenty, but a land of few. And beyond the domestic political choices, it is also the discovery of a new limitation for the country. The United States cannot afford a new stimulus. Rather than a multi-decade collapse like the Japanese situation, many decision makers will be tempted by shock therapy, the same therapy that, with the IMF, the United States recommended to Latin America, Asia, and Eastern European countries. This is normally a good reason for the rating agencies, always so quick to see the straw in the eye of most countries in the world, to threaten the United States with a strong downside rating if they do not implement a comprehensive austerity plan as quickly as possible. But anyway, for Leap 2020, due to the internal and external conditions in the country described above, it is really in spring of 2011 that the United States has an appointment with austerity, an appointment that the rest of the world will impose if it is paralyzed politically. Until then, it is likely that the Fed will have unconventional measures, which is a technical term meaning desperate attempts to try to prevent arriving there, because at this stage, one thing is certain concerning the consequences of the United States entering a large-scale program of austerity. That will be financial and monetary chaos in the markets, accustomed for decades to the exact opposite. That is to say, U.S. waste and an internal economic and social shock unparalleled since the 1930s. So, in layman's term, this Leap 2020 article is saying that the November elections will show the American people upset with the current situation in the country, that with the Republicans being elected, that there will be gridlock in the U.S. Government, and as it's realized that the economy is not recovering, the Fed will seek to do quantitative easing, which they've already announced they're going to start to do. Goldman Sachs says they may announce a serious quantitative easing up to perhaps $1 trillion in November, December. That will cause lack of confidence in the financial markets. It will cause the collapse of the dollar, the devaluing of the dollar, and a call by the international community for austerity measures, which Leap 2020 says we should see by the spring of 2011. Now, regarding the issue, is the United States economy going into deflation or inflation? As it regards to housing, it will be deflation. But as far as food in everyday items, it will be inflation, the worst of all worlds. And as Leap 2020 says, a revisiting of the 1930s in America, that will result in social unrest in the United States. Now, if we do see the fulfillment of these events regarding the U.S. economy, I believe that the collapse of the U.S. economy, the devaluing of the dollar, these austerity measures, is a tribulation event. It's the collapse of financial Babylon, wherein the world will restructure, no longer seek to look to the United States, and their solution will ultimately be one world government, a international financial system with one world currency. That setup of that is the beginning of the last 3.5 years. Now, what we need to see is between now and then, which seems to be not very far off, as early as 3 to 6 months, if we're going to see a framework agreement in the Middle East. Because biblically speaking, the dividing of the land results in the judgment of the nations, which is economic collapse as well as war among the nations. And so with the economic collapse, we should also see war be brought about as well. And from a biblical perspective, the reason why the God of Israel is allowing these things to happen is the tribulation is a period of time set aside to end the exile of the house of Jacob, to unite the 12 tribes of Israel, and to return them to the land of Israel, wherein the beast system will be defeated and the Messiah of Israel will be glorified through gathering his people back to the land. And during this time, we will see the birth of the biblical state of Zion. And we are going to conclude the 5-minute update with two Big Brother articles. One is an awareness in an article that was put out by Time that cell phone companies and thus the United States government can tell where any individual is at any moment when you carry your cell phone. So this is like a Big Brother thought. So in this Time article, September the 15th, the headline is, "What Your Cell Phone Could Be Telling the Government." Smartphones do many things these days. Surf the internet, send email, take photos and video, and oh yes, send and receive calls. But one thing they can do that phone companies don't advertise is spy on you. As long as you don't leave home without your phone, that handy gadget keeps a record of everywhere you go, a record that the government can then get from your telephone company. When you carry a cell phone, it is constantly sending signals about where you are. It pings nearby cell phone towers about every 7 seconds so it can be ready to make and receive calls. When it does, the phone is also telling the company that owns the towers where you are at that moment. Data the company then stores away indefinitely. There is also a second time of locational data that phone companies have thanks to a GPS chip that is embedded in most smartphones now. That is even more accurate. Unlike the towers, which can only pinpoint a general area, which you may be, GPS can often reveal exactly where you are at any given moment within a matter of meters. There are some good reasons for this, which is why the government is actually forcing the phone companies to do a better job of knowing where you are. In the name of improving emergency services, the Federal Communication Commission will require phone companies to meet benchmarks in 2012 for how closely they can pinpoint a caller's location. About 90% of Americans are walking around with a portable tracking device all the time, and they have no idea, says Christopher Calabrese, a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union. Now, the final article for this week's 5-Minute Update. It's from WorldNet Daily. It's also a Big Brother article. September the 15th. The headline is, Pennsylvania state tracked and reported on constitutionally protested protests. The state of Pennsylvania has been paying a private contractor to spy on non-threatening protesters exercising their First Amendment rights and then reported them to officials and corporate executives. And Governor Ed Rendell says he's embarrassed by the situation. A lawsuit is also being promised. In the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, reported City Councilman Doug Shields said some answers need to be supplied. There will be requests of information from the state government for an explanation of who these people are, who made the decision to essentially engage in espionage, and who is behind it, he said. Published reports in Pennsylvania said the state had paid a nonprofit organization $125,000 to compile a list of protesters in order to protect public infrastructure. The work apparently involved protesters against shale gas drilling, a rally regarding education and anti-tax efforts. The Department of Homeland Security then compiled a list of observations about the protesters and provided that to law enforcement and government officials as well as gas drilling companies, according to the Tribune Review. So we have Big Brother alive and well in the United States, capable of tracking, and in many cases are tracking, and often without your knowledge, about where you're at and what you are doing. So we covered in this week's 5-Minute Update the current situation of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, of which we will fully understand the direction of them in the next week to 10 days. We looked at the United States situation with its economy, but the Federal Reserve is indicating it's going to once again begin buying back U.S. Treasuries. That's the printing of money, monetizing the debt. If they do it in a large way, which Goldman Sachs says they might announce in November or December, that would bring about lack of confidence toward the U.S. economy among the financial markets. We could see a collapse of the dollar, a devaluing of the dollar. It will result in hyperinflation. It will be deflation for housing, but inflation for food. Leap 2020 says that would cause a call by the world community for austerity measures in the United States. Leap 2020 says we should begin to see this by the spring of 2011. Meanwhile, Big Brother knows exactly where we're at and what we are doing. So these events that I'm sharing with you are events that in their full manifestation are related to the tribulation, indicating how close we possibly are to being in the tribulation. And we will continue to keep you updated regarding these developments as we share with you them from a Hebraic perspective. Now, in the next week, we will be celebrating the Feast of Sukkot, and there's a possibility that even though I will be at Sukkot, that we will bring you a 5-Minute Update. If it's not done live, it may be taped to be presented to you. That is a possibility. I don't know right now whether that will be the case, but it will be the possibility. So if you do have access to the internet during the celebration of Sukkot, do look to see if indeed we do provide for you a 5-Minute Update, as it will be important to see what the decision will be made by the United States, by the Israeli government, regarding the settlement freeze. Until we do it again, Shalom and Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.